Good morning. How's everyone doing? Doing well? It's great to be here with you. Thank you for having me. It's great to meet all of you. I was mentioning to Dean as we were getting ready, it's just so exciting to see all of you folks at a very beginning point in your life. I know it doesn't feel that way. You've been around for 17, 18 years, but it's a kind of beginning point. You're heading out into the world. And I've been praying that what I have to say about following Christ is going to help you in that journey. When we read this passage that you just heard, one of the things that strikes me as I've thought about it and mulled it over and meditated upon it again and again is that it is a really scary passage. I never looked at it that way before, and it hit me all of a sudden. This is really scary. You have some guy walking around, and he stops. You, follow me. I mean, I don't know how that hits you. The one reason perhaps it hits me in that way, yesterday I remembered back to something that happened in my life. It was in 1970. It was a very good year, but in many ways it wasn't. And the thing that I remember was how it wasn't a good year. It was May of 1970. Kent State had taken place. 4 university students were killed, and universities all across the United States were having uprisings, having revolutions of one kind or another going on. And the university which I was attending was part and parcel of that whole thing. And we had a rally, I don't know, 20, 25,000 students. And I was asked to speak to the student body at that rally where everyone was enraged, everyone was hating the government, hating the militia, hating the National Guard, just hating. I wasn't a believer. I was part of that hate. And I remember getting up, I started talking about what we should be doing, tearing down the establishment, you know. I hate to even say burning this or burning that. That rhetoric was all around. What do I know what I'm doing? I'm just saying, go ahead, come on with me, follow me into this, let's take it down. The next thing I know, I'm up there at the podium, and 20,000 students are running. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, what I felt like throwing up. You know, what have I done? What am I doing here? And they're just gone. And so when I looked at this, I haven't thought about that event in a long, long time, but as I was thinking about this passage, it really hit me that what we have is something in some ways like that. There is a powerful statement being made, follow me. I remember it with, I look back on that with terror because the consequences can be so enormous. Jesus uses that approach, though, with almost everyone that he gets connected with. He goes to people and what he says is, follow me. Here, he's talking to this guy. He's walking along the road and he stops and he sees some guy. You, follow me. No introduction. If you take a look at that passage, there is nothing else that's recounted that Jesus says to Levi. Now, you might say, what would you think he would say? Well, I would think he might say something like this when he stops. I know you. You're the guy who steals money from my mishpucha, my family, my clan, my people. But he doesn't say anything. There's no rebuke. There is no judgment. There is nothing but those two words, follow me. Now, I have a number of questions that this passage raised in my mind that I want to just go over with you because I think these questions are central to understanding what's involved in following him. First of all, what in the world was he asking Levi to do? Did you ever think about that? What is he asking him to do? You say, well, of course, we don't know what he's asking him to. Follow me. What does that mean? Does it mean, hey, I got a wedding, we're going to have lots of wine at the wedding, follow me, we'll have fun at the wedding? Well, no, it doesn't mean that at all. It means something that in the Jewish mindset was connected with being a disciple. Those words were buzzwords, and it meant something very specific. You can see it even in a chapter earlier with Peter and John, and they're fixing the nets, and Jesus says, "Follow me." And it says they got up and left everything. Well, he didn't hypnotize them. They did that. Here he says the same thing. And this man gets up and does it because he knows what's involved with that idea. He's calling me to follow him. It means everything. Everything is given up to be with this man. The second question is this. Why did Jesus do this? Forget the other people he called. Why did he do this with Levi? Why did he stop at a tax collector, a tax gatherer, someone who the people hated, who Rome used, who let himself willingly let himself be used like this? Why? There's only one thing I can make out of this. He did this because he wanted Levi to be a follower of his. He wanted Levi to be a disciple. That's it for that question, plain and simple. The third question I have is this. To me, this is the central question of the whole small text that we have here. This, to me, is what really makes it an interesting, very interesting situation. Why in the world did Levi get up and, as it says, leave everything? Why did he do that? Probably most of you have no connection with the synagogue at all. I grew up in the synagogue. I was with a few friends from Geneva last night, and one of them asked me a question. Were you Orthodox? It was an interesting question because I remember the way I answered it was this. I said, well, when I grew up, I used to be in the synagogue every morning, every evening, 7 days a week. Every single day. And then I went on to say, I remember why I left. I left the synagogue because we had this long 20-minute silent prayer. It's the Shema. If you ever go to a synagogue, and you should sometime to see what's going on there, because it's a very interesting place. It's very exciting. If you see the movie The Chosen by Chaim Potok, you will see what a Jewish synagogue service is like. It's wild. It's interesting. Very Pentecostal. And it's tremendous time, seriously. Well, my goal in the synagogue as this young guy was to become the fastest prayer in the synagogue during this 20-minute silent prayer. So I had the whole thing memorized. And, you know, took me a while, and all of a sudden, one day, I finished, go on and on and on for 20 minutes. Well, I was less than 20 minutes. I mean, I was worked it out to a science. And I finished dominating, I'm rocking back and forth, finished, open my eyes, and the only other people in the synagogue were these old men who would come every morning. These old men from Eastern Europe, survivors of this concentration camps, and me. And I'm standing there. It was the first time I had time on my hands during a worship service in the synagogue. And I'm standing there and I'm going, I don't have any other goals here. Why am I here? I couldn't answer the question. I had no reason for being there. And so I walked out of the synagogue that morning. I just left. And I never walked back until years later, when I came to faith in Jesus. The first high holy days as a believer, I'm lying in bed with my wife, and all of a sudden it hits me, I've got to be in the synagogue. I've got to be in the synagogue. And so I say, come on, it's Yom Kippur. And we get to the synagogue, and we start singing and the praises and the psalms in Hebrew, and I'm lifting my hands and I'm praising God, and tears are streaming down my face. And the rabbi stopped the service. And he looks out in a packed congregation on the highest holy day of the year, and he said, To what can this young Judean attribute his joy in the Lord? That was probably the biggest mistake that rabbi ever made in his entire life. And I just stood there and gave my testimony, watching his face drop and drop and drop. And all he can do at the end of my testimony on the highest holy day of the year is to say to his congregation, "This service is now over. I want everyone to leave and not to speak to the meshumad." That means the apostate one. I'm not going to go into how I went back to the synagogue the next day, because I did. At that time, he gave every male in the synagogue, that's the way, it's very, very discriminatory that way and segregated, everyone a blessing. And he said, "You remember how you get to heaven if you're a Jew? You keep one law a day. And here's today's law. Keep away from the apostate one." I mean, imagine people get to heaven by not talking to me. This is really an extraordinary event in my life to have this thing happen. My wife and I leave the synagogue, that the evening service, though. We leave there, and we walk outside, and we don't know what to do. And I said, "Let's pray over this synagogue." So we laid hands on the building, and we just prayed over this building. And the young people started coming back. They wanted to hear. They wanted to hear about this Yeshua that caused me to weep with joy and for their rabbi to throw them out. And then the Jewish Defense League came, and then they definitely threw us all out. But that's the armed forces keeping people from anti-Semitism. So, you know, think about this. Here's Levi. What's he leaving? He's leaving a Judaism. He's leaving a Judaism that hates him, actually. He has no fun in it. I mean, there's nothing good for him. When he would go to the synagogue, he would be viewed as apostate for other reasons, that keep away from this man. Think about his life. Think about him. He's sitting there. You know, you can think about Jesus coming up to him. But I have something better to think about in one sense. Think about him maybe before Jesus is getting up to him. He's sitting along the road. He's got his table at the edge of town, because they won't have it in the middle of town. He's sitting there and thinking, "How did I get to this place in life? What's it all about? Why am I here? What am I doing? What's the meaning of this? My life is ridiculous. All it is money. Everyone hates me. My countrymen hate me. My family has to hide away because of what I do for a living. I hate this. I hate it. I wish there was a way out." That's sort of how I anticipate, it's expect that this whole thing came about. Then all of a sudden, there's Jesus walking. He maybe looked up and saw this rabbi, this new rabbi in the area, the one who had renown and fame, walking slowly towards him. And you can just feel his guts constricting as he thinks to himself, you know, what's he going to say to me? What's going to be his verdict on my life? What do I have to hear from him now, another rabbi, to condemn me for what I'm doing? And as he sits there, maybe with his head bowed in shame, what does he hear instead? He hears, "Follow me." You don't hear a word of an instant's hesitation. There's nothing that hesitates in him. It says he just gets up and leaves everything. Everything that drew him down, everything that defined him as rotten, as corrupt, as sinful, as wicked, he leaves it all. You know, when I think about this, what does it take for a person to get to that point where he's willing in that instant to leave everything of his life behind? And I think back again, not as far back as that Kent State thing, but I think when I was at the medical center working in the Department of Psychiatry and Clinical Psychology and had the opportunity to lead one of my patients to Jesus Christ under severe, intense self-doubt that I should ever do this, thinking it could cost me my career, and I only had the career for 8 months and I worked all my life to get there. But I knew this man was desperate. I'm not going to go into the story of what happened with him other than to say this was a guy who hadn't spoken in 4 years. He started speaking, not only speaking, but sharing the Jesus Christ around the ward, and I was given a choice. I was given a choice the next day. This is the day one of after his conversion. The choice was, if we want you here, we want you at this place, but you have to promise us never, ever to bring Jesus into your psychotherapy again. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I'm just a baby Christian at the time. And I'm thinking, what do I do? Where do I go? How do I look at this? I went home that night. I needed to read something. I went, where would I read anything about this? And I opened to the book of Acts, and I just read and read through it and read it again. And at the end of reading the book of Acts, I came to one clear decision where the apostles said when they're before the Sanhedrin, we must obey God rather than men. And I went back into the hospital. Everything at that point, everything I had dreamed of, everything I'd hoped for, everything that I wanted in life was, as far as things were concerned, I knew at that minute I was saying no to everything. I was leaving, a final leaving of everything behind me at that point, and yet I did it. So there's another element. Why does a person do that? Why did I do that? Why did Levi do that? Well, you know, I've thought about this question as well. John gives us a hint into this. He said, we beheld his glory, filled with grace and truth. And I know what it was for me. He was the truth. I mean, I asked the question, is one man's salvation worth more to me than my career? And I answered it, yes. He asked the question, is this man who comes to me, this rabbi who loves me, who wants me to be with him, who speaks words that people say are filled with truth and authority, not like the rabbis, is it worth giving up everything for him? And he answered the same way. He said, yes. He said, yes, it's worth it. It's worth it because he is filled with grace. He is filled with truth. Not only that, John later goes on to say, he is the truth. What will we do for what is true in a world that's filled with lies and deception and corruption when you find truth? You know, I met up with a batch of my friends who were working in Hollywood. It's from New York City. They migrated there. And they said, you know, there was one thing about you we always liked. I said, what was it? They said, you were always interested in the truth. And I thought, when they said that, that is the most incredible thing I've ever heard, because I had no, as far as I knew, I had no interest in truth. I had no concern for what was truth. But you know, they saw something. That something brought me into their fellowship, so to speak. But more than that, it brought me into his fellowship, because he is the truth. And even as someone coming from an Orthodox Jewish background, I was prepared to give up things which caused me to weep with joy when I went back to them for the sake of knowing him. There's another question that struck me about this little passage. Why does he say what he does later on? Well, first of all, he says what he does about himself being this physician. He says it for a very simple reason. These guys who came to the house, a bunch of Pharisees, a bunch of religious scholars, some lawyers who came to see what's going on, they made it clear about their disdain and their despising of what was going on. What kind of a teacher can this be? Can this be a rabbi? He eats with sinners and tax collectors. They despise people. They despise them. And there's Levi, who's just been touched by grace, touched by love, connected to Christ because this man wanted him with him even in spite of what he was. And Jesus makes it clear about whom he wishes to associate with. I want to be with them because they're sick. He likens himself to a physician. And I started thinking, my doctor loves me. You may say, that's strange for a doctor to love you. I led him to Christ, so he loves me. but maybe he would have loved me if I didn't, but he does. And I think about the way he treats me when I've had some serious things that I've had to deal with. I mean, he puts me aside and says, Rich, this is what you've got to do. Your life can be at stake in this. You can't go on in such and such a way. You've got to do this. And you know what gets me about it, what makes me want to do it? Because I watch him and I say, this guy really cares for me. That's what he's saying here. You know, people look at that little retort to the Pharisees and they think, this is a rebuke to the Pharisees. I don't think it's a rebuke to the Pharisees. When he wanted to rebuke them, he had real rebukes. He didn't say, the physician comes to those who are sick. He said, you whitewashed tombs, you're filled with worms, you're dead man's bones. He didn't do that because he wasn't concerned. He wasn't even concerned about them. He was concerned about Levi and Levi's family and Levi's friends. So he speaks to them and says, you guys, listen to how I answer this. I'm your doctor. You're my patients. I'm here to make you whole. I'm here to make you whole. And actually, when it speaks of Levi in another place, when it speaks of him, it says that he was saved. And really what's being spoken of there, the word that's used is made whole. Not just that he had a redeeming experience in the face of Jesus Christ, but that his whole being was changed. Everything about him was brought into union with God, fellowship with God. He was changed inside out. He was a new person because the physician of his soul had reached into his heart and gave him newness and transformed him from beginning to end. Well, you know, it leaves one other question. How does Jesus do this now? He's in heaven. How does he get people to follow him now? He's not walking through the aisles here and looking down and saying, you, follow me. How does he do it? You know, he uses us. And you know something, friends? If people will not see Jesus in us, they're not going to see Jesus, because Jesus isn't walking through the streets now. He's using us to walk through the streets and the roads. Let me give you an example of something. I got a call from a pastor on the other side of the country recently. He said, a lady in my congregation's husband died. He's an elder in the church, good elder, good man. She wants to speak to you. And I go, okay. Gives me the telephone number and the name. I go up. I go, hello. I'm sorry to hear about your husband. My name is Rich Gans. I got your number from a pastor. I'm waiting. She starts to cry. I go, uh-oh. What happened? I'm really sorry. But she says, no, I'm not crying for my husband. I said, what is it? She said, well, let me tell you. You don't remember. I said, I don't know yet what happened. She said, well, you were out on a road somewhere in the middle of the United States, Midwest United States, and you were out running, and you ran into my husband, and he was out running, and two of you started running together, and he told you that he's Jewish, and you started telling him about the Jewish Messiah, and then you went on, and you kept going, and I remember the run then. It was a very easy run because it was about 10 miles. It was lots of hills. So that's a great way to do road evangelism on hills, because the people you're speaking to really get too exhausted to refute what you're saying. So if you're going to do highway evangelism, do it in hill country. And she said, and I remembered, we parted. I urged him. I said, listen, brother, follow the Messiah. It's a Jewish Messiah. Come to faith in him. Trust him. The sin bearer, the Lord Mashiach, he's yours. And we parted. 25 years. Never heard from him. Didn't call him. Didn't have a telephone number to call. Never spoke to a word to him again until that call from his wife. And she said, he came back and said, at the end of that run, when he got home, he said, I came to believe in Jesus on the highway with some guy I met. And she said, a few days later, I came to faith in Christ. Then shortly after that, our children came to faith, then our extended family. I'm thinking of Levi when I'm writing this. I'm thinking, that's what he did. That's what he did. He invited people. He invited them all. This is what this guy is doing. That's what I was doing. I was just inviting people to follow Jesus. That's what you have to do. It's not a paradigm of some kind of magic words you use. Follow Christ. Follow Christ. What are you talking about, guy? No, it's not that. It's opening your heart to the hearts of the people you meet on the road, like Jesus did with people. And it was always along the road. He's on the road. He's walking through a town. He stops. He sees a tree, a man sitting in a tree. Zacchaeus, come on down. Today, salvation's come to your house. Wow, we can't do it exactly like that. We're not Jesus, but we can do it in the same kind of way where we speak to their hearts, let them know who they are, what they need, who they need in Jesus, the Messiah, and it opens the door. And this guy became an elder in a church, was used for years and years. And you know, what the lady said to me, to sum it all up, she said this. She said, you didn't even really remember the situation. But what for you was a situation you forgot was the single most important event in the history of our family. You know, this is life. This is what happens. Sometimes you stop calling people to Christ because you think, what good is it going to do? People aren't listening. People don't care. I've spoken and no one listens. No one's interested. You don't know that. You never know the influence you're going to have. You don't know it at all. I was confronted by a guy in a store. He comes up to me, starts speaking to me in Yiddish. So I respond to him in Yiddish. That's the Jewish dialect that's spoken at home. No one ever thought I understood Yiddish at home. That's all they spoke because they didn't want me to understand anything that they were talking about. So I never told them I understand everything you're saying. They would just look at me and they would try things like, well, what do you think about that, Rich? And I'm stupid. I don't have a clue. Go on to your next question. But so I'm speaking back to the guy in Yiddish, and he just wanted to make contact with a Jew. I invite him to my home. My wife and I, we give a meal, we're talking, we share the gospel with him. I read from Isaiah 53, the passage that brought me to faith in the Jewish Messiah. I read this to him, and he gets up in anger and rage. He storms out of the house. Now, you see, I would think, here's a guy that obviously no influence other than anger and rage. There was a woman who was in our congregation who was on a bus ride to Toronto from Ottawa about 8 years after that event. She sits down, she opens her Bible, she starts to read, and she said, a guy next to her said, oh, I see you have a Bible. Can you turn to Isaiah chapter 53? So she says, sure. And he says, would you read it? And he says, who is it speaking about? Is it speaking about Jesus or is it speaking about someone else? I want to know what you think. She says, it's absolutely speaking of Jesus. He's the Jewish Messiah, the Jewish Lamb of God. And the guy goes, oh, this is driving me crazy. I can't stand this. She says, what do you mean? What's the problem? He said, I ran into some crazy Jewish pastor years ago, and I can't get this out of my head. She said, who's the pastor? She said, Rich Gann. She said, oh, that's my pastor. But you never know your influence. You never know the impact you're having. You don't have to see something come about. You don't have to see the end of it. You don't need that at all. But you know something? What we do need to see is, look, this guy, 25 years earlier, I meet him on the road. We're on the road together. 25 years later, he's on another road, and his number is up. He's done in a fiery crash. But you know something? It doesn't even really matter in one sense. It doesn't matter because he's safe. He's home. And you know, I was thinking about this in relationship to a little video that I saw recently. I sent it to Dean. I said, hey, Dean, let's show it up there. Oh, that's me. Hey, hi, Rich. But I guess he wanted to show me instead of the video I wanted to show. The video was a video by Nickelback. Familiar with Nickelback? Great group. Of course you are. I'm going to read you a few words from one of their songs. They have a video with one of their songs. And video. Here are a few words from that song. Heaven's gate won't open up for me. With these broken wings, I'm fallen. I'll show you what I can be, so say it to me. Say it to me, and I'll leave this life behind me. I'll leave everything, so say it to me. Say to me that I'm worth saving. Hurry, I'm falling. Help. Incredible words by an incredible musical rock group. But the video is even more interesting. The video shows people rushing by madly in a major city. And the thing that shows up on the video is that they have numbers above their heads. Each one has a number. And so as the video progresses, you get the idea. Whoa, that's the amount of time they have left. And only one person can see that number. And he looks, and he's just looking for someone whose number is up. Now remember, this is an allegory kind of thing. And what he does is, this is Nickelback trying to say, they're dealing with the issue of, you know, we have just moments to live. What do we do? And it shows people it shows a man who then sees someone who has 3, 2, 1, and he tries to grab the person. He doesn't know what's going to happen, but like a crane comes down and there's a disaster. And it's averted because he grabs him. Now, of course, it's appointed for all people to... hit me so powerfully with is, we can realize that everyone has that number. When we're dealing with people, we won't see a number on the head, but it could be 3 hours and 27 seconds, it could be 3 months, it could be 3 years, it doesn't matter. The fact is, we are all coming to that place. The only way out of it is when we're following Christ. Following him means we're with him in such a way that the path that leads to destruction is stopped. It's stopped up for us, and we are given another direction. We're set in another path, and he takes us with him on that path. That's why it's so critical to follow him. That's why it's critical for you to bring him to others. That's why it's so critical also for me to bring him to you. To end by asking you, are you following Christ? Meaning, are you with him? Meaning, are you giving up everything, or are you holding on to things of yourself? Your old ways, your old lusts, your old habits, the desire for fame or money or success or whatever it might be. I'm calling you to rethink these things. Think about them within the context of the truth of God, within the context of the God who is truth. I'm calling you to think about that and see if it isn't worth everything. Worth everything you have, everything you think you want, just to be with him. When I did what I did 35 years ago now, I cried. I'm not going to pretend, I just made the best decision of my life. I thought it was a horrible decision in some ways. I thought, what am I going to do? I don't know anything else. What am I going to be? What can I even think of? But you know, I look back on God's hand. I could have taken another way, but by God's grace, I didn't. The way was following him. It's not once and for all. It's day by day. It's not even day by day. It's moment by moment, thought by thought, to follow him, to be with him. Dave mentioned connected with him as it wasn't my message, but that's where it is. Because that's what following Christ is all about. It's being connected, inseparably connected with the God who loves us and took our number for us. So when that crane or that crash comes, he took it for us so that the pain and the crush and the sting of death passes us by. Every one of us who loves him and is following Jesus. Let's pray. Father, thank you for Jesus. Thank you for making him the hitman for us, so that even if we are hit, we can stand under whatever it might be, as long as we are following Christ, following Yeshua, HaMashiach, the Messiah, through this life and not into death, but into glory. I pray that every single person in this place may know, experience Christ, his beauty, his love, his glory. In his name, amen.